So welcome, everybody. There's always a couple of mystery callers whose identity I can't tell. But otherwise, I see familiar names here. And we have, what, about 10 people here. So kind of within the range of what we've come to expect. So welcome, everybody. And we're going to start, you know, kind of jump right in on the assumption that everybody has participated in the last course. I did post a short orientation. There's some background noise coming from someone. Maybe we could figure out who that is.
Sorry, it's me, I think.
Okay. So I did post a short orientation, but only yesterday. I'm sorry it was so late. If you haven't read it, I don't think it's going to interfere with your ability to make sense of what I'm planning to say, of what I do say. So we really have been looking very carefully at the structure of time, and the whole, you know, if you want to go back and think about what the last quarter was about, we started off with the structure of past time and how pervasive that is and how we really do organize our experience in terms of past time. Okay, there's still somebody, I think it's called in user 4, whoever that is, there was a lot of noise, but presumably that can be fixed. Okay, so we looked at past time, and then we switched the focus to future time. And the basic structure, I guess, that we're working with is that if we could switch the focus, if we could really engage the dynamic and the aliveness of time, and the source of that dynamic and aliveness is, in a sense, the future. I mean, the place to look for that is in the arising of the future, although we'll see today that you could also say that very differently. But if we could find a way into the aliveness of time, that would change everything. And at the end of the last program, we started exploring how we could do that. Now, we've been exploring it experientially, you know, with many, many different ways of looking for or discovering that aliveness, that quality of time, you know, the flight of the bird instead of the resting of the bird. We talked about it many, many different ways in the last course. So we've been doing that experientially, and we've been looking in terms of the future as the possible location for that aliveness or as a way of engaging that aliveness. So now we're looking at another possibility, and this came up at the end of the last reading in the last session, which was that we could know time inwardly. And what we looked at in the reading was you know, what we were looking at in the last chapter was the structure of the witness. The witness is the one who sets things up according to a particular story, according to a particular structure, and we want to be able to challenge that way of engaging time. So a good statement of that, and this is where I want to start, and it is in the reading from last program, is on page 112 at the top. Rinpoche says, the real question is whether a way of knowing not bound to the witness is available. So when we engage time in terms of the story that the witness tells, we are limiting our possibilities for knowledge. And we would like to challenge that limit. Is there another way of knowing possible? And the reason I wanted to emphasize this particular passage is because Rinpoche does go on to say, if we're looking for a different kind of knowing, we'd be making a mistake if we thought that it looked like the usual kind of knowing, right? He says, we should not expect decisive or definitive answers, for such answers depend on the style of knowing and temporal patterning that we wish to call into question. We should be ready to proceed without requiring premature determinations. So we're looking at the possibility for knowing differently through a different understanding of time. And with that thought in mind, we're ready to consider what the first, you know, what this reading does. The chapter that we're working on now, which is called Conducting Temporal Sameness, and the word conducting, as we're going to see, comes to play a really big role. That chapter is going to keep us busy for the first 4 weeks of this course. That's what we're going to be reading. And the reading for today was a fairly short reading that introduces the basic points and themes. So if you look at the reading for today, it starts with a very specific question, and it has to do with this possibility that we could know time differently, specifically that we could know time inwardly. And we want to figure out, perhaps, what that means. So the chapter starts with a question. Does turning to know time inwardly mean knowing time directly? And the reason that that question gets asked, I think, is because it sounds kind of promising. You'd say, well, yes, that's exactly what we want to be able to do, is know time directly. But in fact, that's not what we want to do. For the reasons that are spelled out, and I think it helps clarify what's going on here, if we recognize why it doesn't make sense to try to know time directly. The reason is, well, or let me put it this way, the chapter gives us a couple of reasons why that's so. But I want to give us another reason that turns on the meaning of the word direct. You know, when we say we know directly, that sounds really good. You know, it's the opposite of indirect and you know, it sounds so immediate, and you know, without anything in between, we just know directly. But in fact, the very idea of knowing directly already suggests a structure of a subject knowing an object. The D in direct is the same as the D in division, or the Sanskrit is in Sanskrit it's V. It has the same meaning in the same basic term. It means to divide. So to say direct sounds like it's immediate, but in fact it's saying there's this distinction between the knower and the known, the subject and the object. So the idea that we could know time directly doesn't really make sense because it's, or let's put it this way, it's too limited a notion because it already presupposes that there's a separation. And since what we care about with time is engaging the aliveness and the dynamic of time, that kind of separation just misses the point. And that's one of the reasons that Rinpoche talks in a lot of different places, including dynamics, but also in other places, that we have to do something that doesn't depend on the structure of from and to. And you know, so that encompasses the idea we can't rely on knowing directly. We can't go from here to there. And in fact, that's one of the fundamental structures of the knowing that goes with our ordinary understanding of time. It's the way the witness knows. You know, the witness knows directly. So if you were in a court of law, you know, you probably, at least in America, people know this notion of of hearsay evidence. That's evidence that you don't know directly. The witness is always only supposed to testify to what he or she knows directly. Well, that's good, that's helpful, but it's not the kind of knowing that we want. So in the book it says a couple of different things about that. The first is that you can't know directly, because in order to know directly you have to have an object that you know, and time can't be an object, because objects show up in time. This is kind of that argument or that point has the flavor, kind of a space flavor to it. It's, you know, it's this division into subjects and objects and the distance between them. That's a spatial way of talking, but it does show us that it won't work for time, and for the other reasons that we've already discussed. And then the second point, which is really important, and it's going to be developed later, but not for a while, but here it's just stated, and that is that, this is in the second full paragraph where he says there's another difficulty, the second full paragraph on 115. He says there's another difficulty. Time as we experience it is structured into stories, right? Events on which we automatically impose a coherent narrative. Okay, so if we were going to know time directly, we would be relying on the structure of the story, which really also means the structure of the witness. That won't work. As he says at the end of that paragraph, if we tell a story about time, that possibility for telling a story depends on time. You know, it's a narrative. It unfolds in time. This happened, then that happened. And so we just haven't gotten to time at all. That's the difficulty. And so these are various ways of talking about the same thing. The question, really, the underlying question that we're exploring is, what would it mean to know time inwardly? And we kind of have an experiential answer to that already that came up through the last course. And that experiential answer is to look for the aliveness of time. You know, aliveness is not subject to any of these problems. There's no distance. There's no structure of from and to. It's just in our experience there's a sense of aliveness. That's an experiential answer. We've been looking at it. And you might say, well, isn't that enough? Why not end the book there? Why not end the section on time right there? And the answer to that, which I think is really, really important to reflect on and see in operation if we can, is that we are so caught up, we are so committed to our usual way of knowing, that even if we have an experience of the aliveness of time, we immediately start to tell a story about it. And this, of course, is one of the big questions that comes up, it seems to me, in a TSK inquiry or in meditation or anything else. It just comes up in so many different ways again and again and again. And that is, if you have a certain kind of experience and it takes you outside the ordinary range of experience, why don't we stay there? You know, it feels really good. It feels as though we have a certain clarity and insight, and probably there's a sense of wellness, of well-being, or harmony, or balance, or so many different words you could apply, and yet we never stay there. Or if we, you know, maybe for a while we stay there, but ordinarily and eventually in every case, we kind of come back to our usual way of knowing. And it's really surprising in a way, because you'd say, well, this is very rewarding, you know, and usually we think of human beings or other sentient beings as operating in terms of, pleasure and pain. We say, well, it's much more pleasurable, much more fulfilling, much more satisfying, much more rich to be alive in the sense that we've been talking about it. and yet we don't stay there. So why is that? And one answer to that question is because we're relying on this other kind of knowledge, the knowledge of the witness, the knowledge that goes from and to, and it doesn't allow for us to stay in that state of aliveness. So we just fall back into our old way of knowing. We tell a story about the experience of aliveness that we may have had, and there we are. You know, we just find ourselves back in the same old reality, the same old way of making sense out of things. And you know, you can say, well, okay, I have a little bit more access to the aliveness of experience, or maybe sometimes for a certain length of time, it seems like we have more access. But the truth of the matter is that these patterns that we have set up and that we are so accustomed to, that have to do with the witness and the ways of knowing of the witness and relying on identity and relying on the self as the one who experiences, it just keeps coming back. You know, it's a little bit like having a cold and you think you're over the cold, but then, you know, you're still kind of a little bit congested or a little bit something is wrong, and then it flares up again. Well, it's kind of like that. We have our usual way of knowing, and we have an experience, and we say, oh, this is so different. This is so meaningful to be able to experience and to know differently. But then sooner or later, the old ways of knowing come up. And that's why we need to be able to challenge at a different level. In other words, not just experientially. And I think that's one of the things about TSK that is very, very important to keep in mind. You know, this, as you all know, when you're studying TSK, there's always the study side and the practice side, the reading and the exercises. And they're both really important. And one of the reasons that the study, the reading, the, you know, going through the process, which is itself a kind of exercise of working with the material that Rinpoche is presenting, one of the reasons that it's so fundamental to the TSK vision is that otherwise, whatever experiences we have, we're just going to plug them back into the same old system. We need to find a way of questioning that system itself. And that's where this chapter takes us. And that's what we're going to be working with for the next few weeks. And the way that Rinpoche approaches that is, he says, okay, I've just told you, and he will explore this more later in the book, but he says, I've just pointed out that the kind of knowing and the kind of experiencing that we are used to is based on stories. And you could say, well, fine, let's just do it differently. You know, I have a knowing that isn't based on stories. And the focus we've been pursuing on aliveness is a way of doing that. But basically, what I've just been trying to say is that in the end, we'll fall back into this story mode. You know, we'll have an experience where we say, I just had this wonderful experience. And even just having said that much, we've already turned it into a story, right? There's the I, and there's the experience, and there's the having of the experience, and there's the just had, so it's in the past. So all of these structures are already operating, and that's just going to happen again and again and again and again. So what Rinpoche says is that we need to have a way of investigating the story structure. And he makes this very interesting proposal. So I'm just kind of laying out what Rinpoche is doing here, because it's very one of those things kind of easy to move through and you know, not really fully think through. So I'm trying to think it through together with you. And the point he's making here is that we can tell a different kind of story. So he says on page 115 at the bottom, he says, we may not have to approach knowledge through stories after all, nor rely on identified objects as the only possible actors in such stories. So this is another way of saying that there's a different possibility for knowledge. We can turn inward, and this turning inward, I say this now in terms of knowledge, but it's presented in terms of time, right? We can understand time by turning inward. And he's saying, if we can do that, if we can know time inwardly, we are no longer relying on stories. But we don't know how to do that. We know how to do it for a while, maybe, when we're doing a certain kind of meditative practice. We don't know how to make that fundamental shift. And he says, he proposes an experiment, essentially. This is not like, here's the answer, here's how you do it. But he says that if we can turn inward and connect to this more dynamic temporality, that dynamic itself, I'm at the top of 116, may be differently available. And then he says, so let's test that out. And this is really the move that he's making in this chapter and what we're going to be working with for at least the next several weeks. He says, let's test that out. Let's tell a story. So I'm just quoting here from the top of 116. Let's tell a story that in its telling evokes a no stories knowing. A story about time that is not based on the structures, the ways of knowing of the witness. So that's what we want to do, and that's where he's headed. Now, I know in terms of the technology here, everybody has been muted, but Kathleen, why don't you unmute people and see if people have any comments or questions on that, because that sort of sets up where we want to go, and I want to make sure that it's clear. So... okay, people are being unmuted. The miracles of technology. You are now free to speak. You're free to ask questions if you wish. Anybody out there? You're also, of course, free to write in the chat box, those of you who are online rather than using a telephone. So is that reasonably clear where we are going to be headed? Or perhaps it's just kind of obvious. You know, sometimes when I take some time to spell these things out, I'm not completely sure that that I need to take all that time. You know, maybe what I'm doing is just kind of evident. If you read what Rinpoche says, well, that's what he's saying. But I've taken the time here to try to lay that out a little bit. Does anybody want to say anything about that? Okay. Then I'm going to move on. Oh, wait, here's a... Sudhi is trying to speak. It says here. There is a message saying Sudhi is trying to speak, but somehow it's not coming through. So maybe Sudhi, if that's the case, maybe you'd better type something. Or maybe Sudhi's not online, so that would be hard. I'm not sure if anybody's trying to speak. I guess I have to assume no one is. And we'll move on. Okay, so the question that the natural question now, and let me just say one thing, by the way. If we have time at the end of this phone call, and I'm not so sure we will, we may try to practice with this a little bit, but in fact, for right now, I think the main practice for us is to stay with this kind of inquiry into aliveness. Where can we find aliveness and experience? So I'm still getting some messages from Kathleen saying people are trying to speak and I'm not hearing anybody. Is that true? Let's see. Caroline, why don't you say something? Well, it's true. I'm not hearing anybody. I mean, but I didn't hear Caroline just now. Let's see. I've got my speakers on. I heard you all fine before. So I don't know what the technical issue is. Well, let me do this. This seems like a kind of a funny workaround. But since you all can hear each other, it seems, some of you who are at the computer and can type, maybe you could be the interpreters for those of you who aren't at the computer and can't type, and could just add some, could just, you know, put in the chat area what it is that people are asking. So, Michael, that means you, maybe, or other people, but anybody who could just type in some questions. I wonder why my... Okay, so I'm waiting just a moment for that to happen. Let me try, I'm going to click on a button here and see if that makes it better or worse. Doesn't make any difference at all. Okay. So, I can see on the computer a lot of people doing things, but nothing is coming across, coming through. So interesting, you can all hear me. Everybody's unmuted, right? Kathleen, why don't you unmute yourself and see if that makes a difference? Okay, let's see. Anybody else want to speak up? Caroline, I'm going to ask you again. Can you say something? Caroline, I'm asking you because you're on video, so I can see your mouth move. But right now, I don't see you. Ah, there you are. Okay, yes, I see your mouth move. I see your tongue touching the palate of your mouth, but I don't see, I don't hear anything. Okay. So Sudhi just says what I said was clear. Okay. okay. We're just stuck with that. Let's move on. I apologize for the technological delay. So, people can certainly, okay. Karen asks, what is the meaning of in its telling? I don't understand this way of testing. Okay, so I understand the question. So we're looking at this first full paragraph on page 116. Rinpoche says, we're testing a possibility. The possibility that we're testing is that if, let's go back a moment to the previous page. He's saying if we can find a way of turning inward toward a more dynamic temporality, the dynamic of time may be differently available. That is, it may not depend on the story. And that's what the testing is going to be about. He's saying, well, it would be nice if, in a sense, maybe it would be nice if we could just drop stories. But instead of doing that, let's try telling a different story. And this is a story that, in its telling, as he says, evokes a no stories knowing, a story about time. Well, what that means certainly isn't clear just from that, but it is very clear if we look and see what he goes on to do. The next section is when he talks about what he calls the conductor's story. So this is the story that Rinpoche is now telling, which is supposed to evoke a no stories knowing. And so you know, my job right now, I think, is to try to see how that works. It's a story that is a story, but it's not a story. That is, it doesn't rely on all the same elements of the story. And that's what we want to explore in the rest of our time. So he starts off with this image that time has its own momentum, and we've discussed that again. We've discussed that. That momentum, he says, has seeded the past into our minds. So he's really saying, you know, you could think about the past as seeds for what's going to arise now. A moment ago, I started to use the vocal apparatus in my throat, and now words are coming out. That's a kind of a very immediate example. Or you could say, you know, sometime recently you signed up for this program, and as a result of that, here you are. You know, certain possibilities have been seeded by the past. But the past has to become the present. So notice that what's going on here is it's actually pretty interesting. We said in the last session, we were emphasizing the idea that the place to find the dynamic of time is in the future. That if we rely on the past, we're always just looking at what's already happened, and there's no aliveness in that. But here he's saying there is an aliveness. You can look at time different. You can look at the past differently. You can look at the past as this moment in which what has already been established becomes the present. It's really just the other side of the future. But let's look at the exact language. He says, the past blossoms into sensations, agitations, and expectations. It erupts into our awareness like a sudden sound, shattering silence. So that's the first step. And then there's a second step, which is the next paragraph. Maybe you could even say there's a third step. The second step is we react to the sound, or rather we react to this eruption, which is like a sound, he says. But in fact nothing makes sense yet. So there's this kind of aliveness. So we're looking not only in the opposite direction, we're not looking at the future, we're looking at the past, but we're looking at the way the past erupts into the present. It's another, you know, if you think about it, you could say, well, when we said before, and I'm thinking about, I think it's on page 99 is the discussion of the future, where Rinpoche says we can just place ourselves at that moment where the future comes into existence. Well, that's a kind of a story too. It's just a description, you could say, of the way the future shows up. And it's an invitation to engage the aliveness of time, and that's why it's important, interesting, and helpful to work with it. Now we're telling a different story, and that story starts with the past. The past erupts into the present. It's like there was nothing, and now suddenly there's this burst. And that burst, that eruption, so think of the eruption of a volcano, except that's actually too slow. It's faster than that. The past, which is everything that is kind of set up to happen. You know, it's you know, the kind of places where we look for causality. It in fact does have to happen, and that happening is this eruption. So something erupts. The past is making itself available as the present. And we respond to it, but the initial moment in the response none of it makes any sense. So he's using the image of sound, and he says, "Well, it's just this all these discordant sounds, this cacophony is the word, not a very common word in English." But it's just all these different sounds, like when an orchestra is tuning up, kind of just a big mess. So that's the second moment. We respond, we take in what showed up, what has erupted, but it doesn't have any structure or meaning yet. So So then there's a third moment. In the third moment, we impose order. And he describes that in the third paragraph, right? The rhythms of perception, interpretation, commentary, and emotionality, thoughts and stories and subjective reactions. And those all have their own momentum and they continue. So this is a story. This is the story that he's telling. This is the no-telling story. You know, at least this is what we're trying to do, is see if we can tell a story that is not a story in the usual sense. So why is it not a story in the usual sense? Well, there's two things to say about that. One is, it's a story about how the story comes into being. So it doesn't tell us anything about the content. Usually stories are about their content. They're something we can describe. But this is about a process. So that's one reason that you can say it's not the usual kind of story. And the second reason you can say it's not the usual kind of story is that it's not really taking place across separate moments of time. That's the way it gets described. You know, so there's three paragraphs, and I said there were three moments, right? So the first moment is this eruption, the second moment is our reaction to it, and the third moment is our imposing meaning on it. So it sounds like, you know, it's going to take, let's say it takes 1 second for a moment of time. It sounds like it's going to take 3 seconds for that to happen. Of course, you might say, no, it doesn't take 3 seconds. It takes, you know, 3/100ths of a second or something. But the point is the same. There are going to be these three successive moments in time. But that's not right. It sounds like that. But it's absolutely not right. Because it's not until that third moment where we've assigned meaning, we've told stories, you know, the rhythms of perception and interpretation and all those things that are mentioned in the third paragraph, it's not until all of that has fallen into place that we can even talk about past, present, and future. That's part of what gets told, you know, that's part of what gets witnessed. So we're kind of telling the story of how the witness and the kind of knowing and the kind of temporality that goes with the witness, how that arises. So that's what makes this a special kind of story, it seems to me. And, you know, Rinpoche goes on to say, well, the themes of the story are well known and predictable because, you know, it's going to be a story like every other story that we tell. When the story finally emerges, it's just going to be just another story. And it's going to have a lot in common with the stories that we've been telling that guide our lives. You know, it's just the way it is. Okay. Rinpoche suggests, and now I'm on page 117, he says, you know, we may not be satisfied with the stories that come into being in this way, that we stand for something deeper. But that's not exactly where that's right, but that's not exactly where I want to focus. The thing that matters here is what he says on page 117, which has to do with this image of the conductor. So this whole section is called the conductor's story, right? What he's saying is that we conduct this moment, you know, which starts with the eruption of the past, and then our reaction to it and our imposing order. The word that he uses for the whole of that process, you could say, is the word conduct. We conduct into being, in as he says at the top of 117, in a way that prepares for the usual narratives to play themselves forward. This is how we set up the story. This is how the usual temporality emerges. And he uses this very image, this very interesting image of being a conductor. It's like, you know, if you're getting ready to listen to a piece of classical music in a symphony hall of some kind, you know, everything is there. Everything has been set up. All the players in the symphony are there. They've tuned up their instruments. The conductor walks up onto the front of the stage. He raises his baton or her baton, and it comes down. That's the eruption, right? That's stroke down. That's the eruption. And then you make sense out of it. And then the piece of music, which is the equivalent of the story, then the story begins to emerge. So when you say this is a no story story, or a no story knowing, it's because the act that creates the music is not a part of the music. Right? It's the conductor conducting that allows the music, allows the story to come into being. And so the point of telling this story is not so that we have another story, because, you know, it's in if you use music as the analogy, you say, well, sometimes there's music and sometimes there's silence, or sometimes there's singing and sometimes there's speech. But in the case of our ordinary knowing, it's all stories all the time. There's always a new story emerging. There's always the next story, and there's always layers of stories interacting with each other. That is not what we want to be doing. We don't want this to be just another story. So it's not meant to be an explanation in the sense of that we usually understand explanations, but it is meant to evoke the possibility that before the story gets set up, and using the word before is already a little limiting, a little bit misleading, because that would sound as like, you know, there's a before and an after, and that, so now we're back in the realm of stories. But still, more fundamental, let's say, than the story, is the conducting of the story. And this is the story of the conducting of the story. We conduct the whole, as he says, you know, this whole structure, this is on the second full paragraph on 117, we conduct the whole of the structure has an organic unity. Each story encompasses the range of stories, from one single thought. This is all very interesting what he's saying here. From one single thought, almost from one single word, we could conduct the whole. So he's talked about the past having been seeded into our minds. And we could really, you know, every seed is the seed of the whole. Every emerging moment in the present is the outcome of a kind of a structuring in the past. At least that's how we're going to understand it. Okay, so I think that's where we have to stop for today. That kind of sets things up. Now, just make a couple of additional observations. One is that story, once it's been conducted, or once, you know, if we take it as just a regular story, then we're the conductors, right? That doesn't get us very far. It doesn't change, you know, we were saying in the last session, the last reading, that we see ourselves as the witnesses. If we see ourselves as the conductors, there's not much use we haven't really gone anywhere. But if we understand that whatever shows up has this no story story, because it hasn't been interpreted and shaped and given meaning and significance, this no story story of the past erupting and our reacting and then shaping to give meaning. If we see every moment like that, and then we see ourselves as part of what, as part of the meaning, you know, the self is the one who's doing this, who's conducting, who's witnessing, so many ways to talk about the self, but they're all part of the story that has been conducted into being. We would like to find a way of staying with the conducting. So that's the test that Rinpoche is testing here. He says we want to test the possibility, right, of making a dynamic differently available. The possible dynamic that we're testing is the dynamic of the conducting through which the story is going to come into being. And I think the analogy to conducting a symphony is that it's through the conducting that the music is going to come alive. And that's true for any work of art. We're looking here at a process, the process of creation rather than what gets created. Okay, so we have one question from Michael and then we'll stop. Is the conductor a momentary interest, like a dog's ear rising before interpreting a sound? You know, I think it's both, or I think it's so there's these three moments, but you can't think of them temporally. The moment of erupting, you know, where the past, everything is ready through the past and now it erupts into the present, the very immediacy. And then there's the reacting to it, and that's like the dog's ears rising. And then there's the making sense of it. And it looks like those are three separate moments in time. What I'm suggesting is that if you want to think of them, if you want to understand this as a no-story story, as a story before stories, or a story more fundamental than stories, then you shouldn't think of them as momentary in the temporal sense. It's a little bit like, I'm not sure if this is helpful, but the word, we use the word moment, mostly we use it to refer to time. It doesn't have to, but it's very strong. We hear that very strongly, that moment relates to time. You might think of the word movement, and I'm thinking here specifically of a piece of classical music that has its movements. There's the first movement, the second movement, the third movement. I guess the really classical structure was four movements, if I remember correctly. And you could say, well, the movements succeed each other, and they do, because, you know, that's how time unfolds. First one note, and then another, and so on. That's how we make sense out of it. But each movement is its own self-contained thing. And together they make up the symphony. And there's something, as I say, I'm not sure this is helpful, but probably especially because I'm not a great, I don't know that much about classical music. But if you say, well, the symphony is made up of these four movements, in what sense is that so? It's not exactly in a temporal sense, although you could think of it that way. It's that somehow all four together create an organic whole. And that's what the conducting here is doing. The erupting, the responding, and the interpreting, to use that shorthand, they're all coming together, and they're all creating the whole. Okay, well, as I said, get back into the practice or continue with the practice of looking for aliveness in all these different ways that we have been looking. Later on in the program, in these next weeks, you know, we'll see that there's a different possibility, another possibility, because we have this image now of conducting, and the question would be, how do we conduct the conducting, or is that what happens? You know, can you conduct the conducting in a no-story way? That's not a question that's raised right here, but it will come up, and that's kind of where we're headed. But for now, we already have a very rich set of possibilities for practice, so stay with those. Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you. I'm sorry for the technical difficulties, and I guess we'll have to try to figure out why that was, but I'm glad you could at least hear me. Okay, goodbye.